Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded change makers, difference makers, and happiness makers. In episode 4, I talked about a cornerstone of self-love, healthy personal boundaries. We considered what self-love is, the selfies or components of self-love. In the wrap-up, I introduced an aspect of self-love we're often tempted to ignore, the embracing of our shadow self. In this, episode 5, I talk about your shadowy side. Why? For two very good reasons. Firstly, your life can only be truly fulfilling when you immerse yourself wholly, not partially, into it. And you can only be whole when you acknowledge and accept your shadow part. Secondly, unless you face your own shadows, you will always see them in others, because your outer world is only a reflection of your inner world. As within, so without. The shadow self has been described variously as being the side of your personality that contains all the parts of yourself that you don't want to admit to having. The dark place within your subconscious mind that contains every taboo thought, feeling, desire, or personality trait that you have rejected, buried, or suppressed. A dark omen, a powerful teacher that reveals to you the places in your life where you are energetically blocked, and when you continue to ignore these signs, you perpetuate the cycle of your suffering. An unconscious aspect of your personality that does not correspond with your ego ideal, leading the ego to resist and project the shadow. In short, the shadow is the self's emotional blind spot projected outwards. As long as we ignore our shadow self, we are not fully alive, and we hurt. And hurt people hurt people. This world doesn't need more hurts. By embracing your shadow self, you address your emotional hurts, and you're enabled to interact more healthfully and happily with others. The acknowledgement and acceptance make you truly whole and able to love and accept everything about yourself. I'm going to share a personal story here about a very toxic secret that I held, or more accurately, which held me fast for 3 decades. I was, as I say in the story, shackled by the toxic twins of shame and blame. Here's my story of me facing my shadow self, illustrated by metaphor. It is spring, 1981, a perfect day. I'm 4 years married at this time, 24 years old, and today I'm making love in an abandoned apple orchard. The sun is filtering through the white blossoms overhead, warm on my face. My long hair splayed across last year's dry brown grass, bees buzzing. The thing is, I'm not with my husband. The thing is, I conceived my eldest daughter in that orchard. The thing is, I hid a shaming secret for almost 3 decades. I thought I hid the secret. I now know it hid me. When, a couple of weeks later, I realized the probable consequences of that afternoon in the spring sunshine, I took that terrifying realization and frantically wrapped it up tightly into a ball. In the dark of night, I carried that oh-so-heavy ball down into the basement of my mind. On the basement floor, I opened a trapdoor onto a deep, deep shaft. Cradling my ball, I climbed the ladder down, down, down into the blackness of the shaft until I reached water level. I dropped that weight into the bottomless cold pool, raced up the ladder, slammed shut the trapdoor, and threw myself down on the door, clinging tightly, holding it shut. But life must go on. A big part of me stayed prostrate there on the trapdoor, on guard. The residual small part of me rushed up out of the basement to go on. A false sense of relief is achieved in denial. Husband, I have exciting news for you. We're expecting. Of course, we, hubby and I, are expecting. We've been trying after all. I went off the pill. I knew my cycle. I knew when it was the right time with my husband and not okay with my lover. I wouldn't take that chance. I mean, that passionate impromptu day in the orchard, I'm pretty certain that was a safe day. Yes, of course it was a safe day. I wouldn't be that careless. No, I definitely wouldn't be. Why are you even thinking about it, Annie? Hubby and I are expecting. It is so exciting. I can't wait to tell our families. It's early 1982. Isn't she beautiful, our daughter? She has her dad's sister's curls, that's for sure. Other than that, she looks exactly like me, doesn't she? I mean, everything about her is me, isn't it? For years, the trapdoor in the basement of my mind stayed shut under my dead weight. Thoughts upstairs in my mind stayed far away from the secret hidden in the pool at the bottom of the shaft. Or did they? When I had dropped that weight into the water, I had not accounted for the fact that the human body is 60% water, our blood 92%. Water flows throughout our body. That water in the pool, contaminated by a toxic mixture of shame and blame, seeped into every cell of my being. No one could see it from the outside, from all external perspectives, and even from the upstairs of my own mind. I was the loving wife. The affair long ago ended. In fact, I was going well beyond the call of compassion, attempting to emotionally support my husband within a very emotionally and mentally challenging relationship. I was the dutiful church member, actively involved in the services. I was the superwoman, working full-time as the primary wage earner while raising four children. Friends and family saw me blaming my husband for my troubles. What they and I didn't see was that in my blaming, I was avoiding terrifying self-awareness. In blaming, I handed over to him the responsibility to make my life better, even though the then me knew I did not deserve a better life. From deep down in the basement of my mind, it could be seen I was the worst of wives, a hider of a secret. All the draining marital challenges were exactly what I deserved. The kids didn't, though. They didn't deserve the toxic fallout of their parents' relationship. God, what was I to do? The woman who went to church, she was a fraud. The sinner woman me couldn't be participating in the services with the faithful. I felt schizoid. And I had no right whatsoever to complain about the unrelenting busyness of being a superwoman, a super screw-up woman, actually. I earned that title. That role kept me fully occupied, so I had no time to think about things. And so it continued. From upstairs, my mind whispered, Annie, you're not happy. You can do better for yourself and for the kids. From deep in my cells, the contaminated water drowned out the whispers. You shameful slut, you still owe him big time. It's summer, 1992, a sunshiny day. We're sitting in the bleachers, my husband and I, with our three youngest, watching our oldest daughter and the other 10-year-olds on the baseball diamond. Then it happened. Sitting on the bench with her teammates behind the screen opposite the catcher, I saw her making what looked like an okay sign until she brought her hand up to her right eye and peered at the batter through the circle her fingers made. I felt as though I'd been punched in the stomach and couldn't breathe. He, my ex-lover, used to do that exact same gesture, pretending to focus on something. Shut up, Annie! A scream inside my head. That gesture was pure coincidence. What the hell? I ran down the steps of my mind into the basement. The estranged, heavy part of me was on hands and knees, frantically holding down the heaving trapdoor. The small, barely functioning bit of me ran back up the stairs. I breathed deeply and turned my attention to the batter as my racing heart gradually slowed. "What is wrong with me?" I silently asked, tears welling up. That question took me by the hand into counseling. I told the counselor my litany of all my husband-related woes. "He's making our family life hell," I said. "How can I get him to change?" "You can't," said the counselor. "It's virtually impossible to change someone else. You can only focus on changing yourself. That's all that's within your control." "But I'm the martyr," I shouted to myself. "Why is it up to me to do the hard, scary work of changing?" It's fall 2002. I'm with my psychologist. I'm so happy with the progress I've made over the past decade. I'm now a veteran of individual counseling, group therapy, Al-Anon. What a game changer Al-Anon was. The seed of self-awareness was planted and the new growth is thriving. In Al-Anon, I came to understand the craziness of codependency and getting tangled in the web of shame and blame. For a long time now, I've been untangling myself, taking back my power. But in 2002, my feet still remain stuck in a sticky web I'm feeling but not seeing. I say to my psychologist, "There's something I have to tell you. It's taken me a long time to find the courage, and it's been weighing heavily on my mind. I had an affair. It was a long time ago." "Is there anything more you want to say about it?" he asked. No, that's it. It's behind me. It just feels good having admitted it." It's half a year later. I say to my husband, "There's something I have to tell you. It's taken me a long time to find the courage. I'm leaving you." It's early 2009. I'm in a downtown Toronto restaurant with my oldest daughter celebrating her 27th birthday. I say to my daughter, "There's something I have to tell you. It's taken me a long time to find the courage." Then I toss the grenade between us, not knowing what I'll see when the dust settles. The most difficult move of my life. I love this young woman intensely. The thought of losing her is overwhelming, but that same love compelled me to share with her a realization that had recently, in the dark of night as I lay sleeping in my bed, climbed up the ladder in the shaft, pushed up the trap door in the basement of my mind, helped up the sprawled, estranged part of me off the floor, and hand in hand with the uplifted part made its way upstairs in my mind. I awoke with the petrifying sureness of what I had to do. When the dust from the explosion settled, my daughter and I were both still standing, still loving each other. I had other grenades to toss. At her biological father, meeting him for the first time in almost 3 decades, asking permission for the DNA test that would come to eliminate any shred of doubt, and introducing him to his daughter. I tossed a grenade at who my daughter knew as her full siblings and at the man she'd called Dad for almost 3 decades. "Sorry, sorry, sorry." No matter how often repeated, it's such an inadequate word. I tossed a grenade at my extended family and another into my circle of friends. Finally, the explosions ended. Somehow, the collateral damage in the telling was minimal. Lives were changed a little or a lot, but in all cases, love prevailed, and it needed to begin with my self-love that was born of self-awareness. Over a span of almost 30 years, I'd gradually come to understand how the toxicity of shame and blame and the accompanying denial were keeping me sick and small and stuck, and thankfully, I also found their powerful antidotes. I now know that the truth of the paternity of my daughter made its way up from my suppressed consciousness into my full awareness Once I was in a mentally, emotionally, and spiritually healthy enough place to let it come up, when I finally loved myself enough to be empowered to do what it took to become whole and real again. I flushed out the shame from my system when I came to accept that, yes, I made a big mistake, and I will continue to make mistakes, but that doesn't make me a human mistake. It makes me human. I can fail without being a failure. I can fall, but I can fall forward. I'm a perfectly imperfect person like everyone else. I've given myself permission to love my flossom self. And the blame, the giving away of my power? When my finger pointing stopped, I realized I was able to pick up and operate the tools I need to address the internal and external challenges in my life to bring about change. The toxic twins of shame and blame kept me shackled by ball and chain. I didn't know I held the key. Self-awareness set me free. The end. Or should I say, the beginning of my next chapter. When I became enabled to stop blaming myself for my major life screw-ups, I could stop blaming life, other people, and circumstances for screwing me up. The shame I cloaked myself in for decades, I eventually was able to discard it. That's not the same as denying responsibility for what I did, for admitting I feel guilty about what I've done. But shame and guilt are separate and distinct. No one explains the distinction better than Brené Brown, an American professor, lecturer, author, and podcast host, known particularly for her research on shame and vulnerability. Brown says, "Based on my research and the research of other shame researchers, I believe that there is a profound difference between shame and guilt. I believe that guilt is adaptive and helpful. It's holding something we've done or failed to do up against our values and feeling psychological discomfort." She continues, "I define shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Something we've experienced, done, or failed to do makes us unworthy of connection. I don't believe shame is helpful or productive. In fact, I think shame is much more likely to be the source of destructive, hurtful behavior than the solution or cure." Brené has also said that guilt implies that you've done something wrong, whereas shame implies that there's something wrong with you. Discarding my shame means loving myself despite the now obviously unhealthy and damaging choices and decisions made by the then me. As I'll talk more about in a future episode, you always do make the best decision in the moment in light of what you have at hand in that moment, based on everything that's gone before. Having an affair was how I'd decided to address unhappiness in my marriage. Staying in denial about my affair and paternity of my daughter was how I decided to deal with what I then perceived as mortal sins. Eventually, by casting light on my shadow through truth sharing, I no longer had to feed my emotional and mental energy to that insatiable dark beast. I freed up energy to love myself and pay uninhibited love forward to others. Again, as with personal boundary setting, there is a caveat attached to truth sharing. Sharing truth that may be painful or triggering to others must only be done in a safe place if there is risk for harm to yourself or others in the sharing. The process, the how, of embracing your shadow self involves firstly accepting where you're presently at in your life as the perfect place to start, and secondly, understanding your influencers, what makes you you, both of which I've talked about in previous episodes. Thirdly, it involves being aware of instances of discomfort or disappointment and reflecting on them instead of blaming someone else or circumstances. Throughout your life, from pre-birth to today, There have been numerous influences or factors that have shaped you into the person you are today. It's important to understand how you've been influenced because such understanding or awareness enables you to appreciate that you are a unique individual who cannot be compared to anyone else, and to accept that there is nothing wrong with you. You are who you are because of everything that has gone before and how you've responded to circumstances. And it enables you to reflect upon how your influencers are continuing to shape your beliefs, thoughts, and behaviors. And it enables you to embrace your shadow self, to be self-forgiving, self-compassionate, self-accepting, self-respecting, i.e., self-loving, flaws and all. With this understanding and awareness, your shadow, your shame and blame are exposed, and once brought into the light through self-awareness and self-love, they can't exist. Rather like vampires, I suppose. And this analogy might be apt because vampires suck out your life essence, your blood, just as shame and blame deplete you. I'll share one more short story of another instance of self-love conquering the shadow. It concerns a loved one who had been battling alcohol addiction for a number of years. She'd been in detox and therapy a number of times and would make headway in the battle only to relapse and fall back again and again. But relapse is not failure with awareness and learning attached to it. It's falling forward. And in that repeated falling forward, however discouraging and dispiriting, something was growing, developing within her. One spring evening, she and I were sitting at a bonfire in a provincial park when I remarked to her that her present stretch of sobriety somehow seemed different than the previous ones, like this one might stick. I asked her why I had that impression. She gazed silently into the fire for a bit and then answered, "It's become because I finally come to love myself enough to do what it takes to get myself better." Where did I hear that before? And better she did get. I invited her to join me in an episode to talk about her journey to self-love and sobriety. Love is a many-splendored thing, as Andy Williams says in his song, and so is self-love. So far, I've talked about two splendors of self-love, healthy boundary setting and shadow embracing. Related to both is yet another splendor, self-forgiveness. Healthy boundary setting entails forgiving yourself for the pain, the confusion, the disturbance your new, firmer boundaries may cause in others, used to a you with flimsy boundaries. Facing and embracing your shadow self can only happen with self-forgiveness. The darkness of shame can only survive without the dispelling light of self-forgiveness. Often, it's so much easier to forgive others than forgive yourself, right? So, why is this? Well, it's often because you hold yourself to a higher standard of accountability than you do others. You expect perfectionism from yourself, but not others. You believe you should always be able to control the outcomes of your actions, and you beat yourself up if things don't go as anticipated. Or it could be that you feel that you, an idiot, a loser, or however you negatively label yourself, don't deserve to be forgiven. You're not worthy of self-forgiveness. Whatever the reason, holding on to guilt long after its expiry date exacerbates the damage to yourself. As alluded to above, guilt associated with your wrongdoing or not doing is important for the functioning of your moral compass, but it's there, not like a rod to self-flagellate with, but like a red flag alerting us that we need to take responsible action, perhaps make amends to another in response to our behavior that gave rise to our guilty feeling. Retained guilt morphs into toxic shame. You might have heard it said that a mistake is only a mistake until it becomes a life lesson. Then, instead of it remaining unhelpfully as a source of guilt, the mistake becomes an opportunity of betterment to do better the next time. I think of mistakes as stumbling blocks that, when learning is applied, they're flipped over into stepping stones that help you move along in the direction of becoming a better you. So, how do you flip stumbling blocks to stepping stones? Here's how, borrowed and adapted from Psychology Today, 7 Steps to self-forgiveness. Number one, acknowledge the guilt you feel. Denying it will only give it more power. Number two, say, I feel guilty, not I am guilty. This makes it clear that guilt isn't a permanent part of who you are, but a temporary feeling that will fade. This distinction avoids the growth of toxic shame. Number three, say, I'm sorry. Say it to yourself, to the person you might have hurt, or to whoever might have been impacted. This is an important part of forgiveness that starts the healing. Number four, remind yourself you are doing the best you can, even when you behave in a way that in hindsight is wrong. In any moment in time, you are doing the best you can with the knowledge you have. Number five, learn and grow from your mistake. Identify what you learned from the situation that has made you feel guilty. It could be a specific life learning, a skill that needs developing, or perhaps a revelation about you and your values. If it was a clear mistake, think about how you can prevent it from happening again. Number six, be patient. Forgiving yourself can feel harder than forgiving someone else. That's okay. It's normal. Simply trust the process. Repeat the steps as long as you need to and be patient and kind towards yourself. Number seven, forgive yourself for not being perfect. You are human, and the best thing about you is that you are real. Forgive yourself for your flaws. This talk about facing and embracing your shadow self, about forgiving yourself, and in the previous episode about setting healthy personal boundaries, is all about self-love. None of it is easy. Self-love isn't easy. It's a slow grower. It takes lots of nourishing. It takes lots of practice to get it right. It's never a completed task. It only took me about half a century or so to stop thinking of myself as fundamentally unlikable. But as long as I didn't like myself, how could I expect anyone else to like me? I'd characterize those decades as lonely, even though I was surrounded by people who I intellectually knew loved me. It was a challenge starting out on the path to self-love, the Be You journey. But there is something that did help me start putting one foot in front of the other. That starter is something I first learned in Al-Anon. It's one of their inspirational aphorisms. It's fake it until you can make it. I've gotten pushback on this in workshops. How can I talk about the vital importance of authenticity and faking it in the same breath? I'll explain that in the next episode when I talk about faking it until you can make it as an oft-times necessary starter to the self-betterment journey. For now, suffice it to say that it doesn't mean being phony or being an imposter. It means imitating or practicing confidence, competence, and optimism until those imitated qualities become the real thing for you. The author, Nikki Rowe, says, "It takes courage to become authentic. So many talk about the light, but not enough speak the truth about the struggles it takes to get there and the tools to overcome it all." I invite you to tune in for a talk on how fakery is a tool for authenticity in episode 6, Better Me, Better World. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.